This is Fresh Air. Did you ever think you should be president? Richard Ben Kramer didn't. When he became a journalist, Kramer started to wonder about presidential candidates. Who are these guys that are confident and ambitious enough to think they deserve to lead the country? Kramer spent the last 6 years trying to answer that question. His new book, What It Takes, profiles six men who were presidential hopefuls in 1988. George Bush, Michael Dukakis, Joe Biden, Richard Gephardt, Bob Dole, and Gary Hart. Kramer is a contributing editor at Esquire magazine. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his Middle East reporting in 1979 for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He wanted to find out who these candidates were as people by talking to them and to nearly everyone who knew them. I told him I thought whatever strengths I have as an interviewer often fail me when I interview politicians because they sometimes lie and usually turn their life stories into self-mythology. I asked Kramer about his approach.
These are not introspective men. They're people who have never had to think about themselves for 15 minutes in their lives because they're very outward directed. Their problems were always getting other people to change their attitudes or like them or move in a certain direction. And their internal clock, their internal methods, their habits of being on the planet were the one thing they never had to worry about. So asking them directly, why do you do a certain thing or what makes you this way, never really worked out that well. What I had to do was keep coming back to them, writing what I thought was true and actually showing it to them so that they could tell me how it looked from behind their eyes. I gave them absolute rights of argument, but in order to convince me to change anything, they had to tell me how it really was for them.
How much access did the candidates give you to their campaigns?
Well, it varied from candidate to candidate and from time to time. For instance, with Michael Dukakis, I got very good cooperation until the point when he saw himself as the putative nominee, at which point the bubble, what I call the bubble, really began closing around him. And the only people with access to him were the suits at the front of his plane.
Yeah, why don't you describe what you call the bubble?
Well, this is kind of central to the book. What I found out in this six-year project was that the life that we thrust these men into, I say men because they have all been men in my lifetime, cuts them off from the normal American life that they set out to improve in the first place. We put them in planes where they're hopping around the country for years at a time. All these brilliant advisors in suits around them handing them papers and telling them where to go and whom they're going to see and what they're going to say to those people. And after a while, the candidate can't see outside this circle of admiration around him. Not only that, we can only see the shiny surface that this bubble erects for us. So sometimes it seems to me that we divorce these men from the very life of brilliance that brought them to the point where they could run in the first place.
And you think that the candidate really loses touch with what's happening in the country?
Absolutely. He loses touch with every vestige of reality and every vestige of his former life.
Are there a couple of things that you could mention about George Bush that made you have a sense of who he is as a person and have helped you understand policy decisions that he's made while in the White House?
Oh, sure. You know, people complain about George Bush in that he doesn't seem to want to use the government to help our society's impoverished or underclass, if you want to call it that. And talks instead about these thousand points of light. And people of my acquaintance can't understand this. They think he must be unfeeling or uncaring. But if you go back into his past, the story that brought made this clearest, made his attitude clearest to me, happened in about 1962 when he'd been made chairman of the Republican Party in Harris County, which is Houston, Texas. And Bush energized the Republican Party, which was a small but growing band at the time. And in fact, they elected their first city councilman, I think the first Republican city councilman ever in the city of Houston, and that fired up the troops even more. And then some months later, there was on the front page of the Houston Post a picture and a story about a terrible event where a baby girl had been bitten by a rat in a Houston housing project. Well, it was, as I say, front page and big play, and the whole city was talking about it. It was a really terrible story. And another man in George Bush's position might have called for improvements to the public housing in the city, or at the least called up the city councilman he'd helped to elect to propose a rat eradication plan, or in some way mounted some assault, some systemic assault on the problems that were illustrated by this story. But George Bush's response was uniquely his. He called up Barbara at home that day, and he said, "Bar, do you think we could give that family our baby bed?" Now, Barbara Bush, who hadn't even realized that she and George were not going to have any more children, was kind of unsure, but he insisted. And in fact, he drove home that day, put the bed into the trunk of his car, and took it right over to that family so the little girl would no longer have to sleep on the floor. And that is how George Bush solved that problem.
What does that say to you about him?
It says that he deals absolutely in particulars. You know, he's a man who got to the presidency one friend at a time. He works by personal exertions and personal attentions. And when I see him now, I'm on a personal level troubled and saddened for him, because he's a guy who is now trying to lead a republic of 250 million citizens and a $1 trillion government and the lone superpower left on the planet, all by personal attentions and personal exertions and kindnesses and invitations to the boat in Kennebunkport or burgers and bloodies in the backyard with Bush. And I can just see him squeezing out the last drops of his energy for us, as he sees it. He is giving over the last and most active years of his life to this quest, which is his, to be the president he saw in himself.
I want to get back to the bed story, where George Bush wanted to give this girl his bed. Couldn't that just be to get a little bit more political attention, to have a kind of heartwarming story of which he would be the hero?
No, I don't think so. I think it's an absolute visceral response from him. He was going to solve that problem. He's horrified that this baby had been bitten by a rat. But the problem to him was not that there were rats all over the Houston housing complex, or that the public housing in the city was run down or ill-administered or ill-maintained. The problem for him, he never saw the system that fostered this rat bite. He just wanted to get that baby off the floor.
It's a real problem for a politician who can't see the larger system that causes the problems.
Well, with all of these men, their strengths are always their problems and vice versa. I mean, George Bush has made his way in the world by this particularity and personalness of his attentions. And only now, when he gets to the top of the heap and, alas, has only his life's same method to bring to the tasks before him, is he criticized for failure to see the larger picture.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Kramer, and we're talking about his new book, What It Takes, which is his study of six men in 1988 who wanted to be president. And he's also a contributing editor to Esquire magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.